Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 9th of December, a very snowy day in much of the state of Wisconsin, and not as bad in Milwaukee, but I feel for you, those of you who have all of that snow to get rid of. Well, you can't get rid of it, to shovel so you can walk on the driveway, you can walk on your sidewalk, etc. So best of everything in tackling that during the course of this day. We hope to be, oh, we do have him. Okay, we were just trying to locate our guest this hour, and we have found him. Greg Mortensen is joining us this hour. He has been much requested by many of you, and his work has been receiving a great deal of national attention, international attention, as you know. He's the author of Three Cups of Tea, which has been a New York Times bestseller for more than 3 years. He's a humanitarian and former mountaineer who believes that the best way to peace is through education. He is co-founder of the nonprofit Central Asia Institute and founder of the Pennies for Peace Children's Program. He received one of Pakistan's highest civil awards just recently in the year 2009, and this book is filled with stories about the work that he's doing. He talks about the fact that it's the stories that really keep him doing what he's doing, and they are absolutely remarkable stories. Greg is with us for the next hour, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for him. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Greg has an interesting life story. He grew up on the slopes of Mount Kilimanjaro, Tanzania, from 1958 to 1973. He served in the U.S. Army in Germany, where he received the Army Commendation Medal and graduated from the University of South Dakota. In 1992, his sister died from a massive seizure after a lifelong struggle with epilepsy on the eve of a trip to visit the town in Iowa where the baseball movie was made, Field of Dreams. And to honor his memory, he climbed Pakistan's K2, the world's second highest mountain. He got lost on the way, very close to the summit, I believe, and met a group of, this is just an amazing story, met a group of children sitting in the dirt, writing with sticks in the sand, and he made a promise to help them build a school, and the rest, as they say, is history. We're very happy to have him with us. Greg Mortensen, hello. What an honor to speak with you. Thank you.
Hi, Kathleen. Good morning. Hi. Hope you're not too much in the middle of that blizzard.
Yeah, we're not at all in Milwaukee, but I've got to tell you, the whole rest of the state just pounded. Huge. Huge.
Oh, well, that's great.
Yeah, I guess.
My wife is snuggled into minus 20 in Montana, where I'm from, so I'm down in Albuquerque, so.
Oh, we don't want to hear about how warm it is. I got to tell you, you are one of the most requested guests whenever we do open lines, and everywhere when I speak at places, you've got to talk to Greg. You are just, you are admired and adored, I think, and beloved here among many people in the state of Wisconsin.
Well, it was actually a bunch of school kids in Wisconsin that really got this started, so my heart is always with the kids in Wisconsin. I had to, when I came back from after climbing K2, I made these kids in a village. I saw 84 children sitting in the dirt doing their school lessons, and I found out they didn't have a teacher there, and they were trying to persevere. So I made a promise to build a school. I had no clue how to fundraise. I had to raise $12,000. So I came back to the States. I hand-typed 580 letters to celebrities and movie stars, and I only got one check back from Tom Brokaw. Excuse me. Sorry. And so my mother, who is a principal at Westside Elementary School, which is in River Falls, Wisconsin, she invited me to come and talk to the kids. This is in the spring of 94. Now, I had never spoken to anybody, you know, adults or kids, about my dream to build a school in Pakistan. When I got done, I spent 2 days there. It was very inspiring. When I got done, there was a fourth grader who I'm still in touch with. His name is Jeffrey, and he said he had a piggy bank at home and he was going to help me. And, you know, I thought, oh, well, what can a fourth grader do? And 6 weeks later, Westside School raised $62,340.
Goodness gracious.
And so that was the biggest check I'd ever gotten, and the pennies inspired adults. And as you mentioned, the rest is history. And the other thing that happened from that is we now have a program called Pennies for Peace. Now, this is in addition to our other work, and Pennies for Peace is a children's program to teach children about caring and sharing, and both locally and internationally. And for lack of better words, it's kind of going bananas lately. It was in 280 schools last year, and this year it's in 4,500 schools. And we not only encourage kids to, help out, different types of endeavors, but we encourage kids to spend time with their elders and then to go out and do things on their own. So it's been and that all started with a little elementary school in Wisconsin. So I always feel great love and thanks to the people of Wisconsin for getting this started with their pennies.
With their pennies. You write in the book about these huge crowds that you have attracted. I mean, huge crowds. And you're a little bit dumbfounded early on, and then you realize, well, people have generous hearts and generous spirits, and there were so many people captivated by what you were doing and thinking it was the best of work that people would wait in line to see you. Isn't that something?
Yeah, I'm pretty much a shy guy. I really wasn't born to, I wasn't made to do this. But what I found is that everywhere I go in America, Americans are very good people. They're very compassionate people and also very courageous people. I think I've seen somewhat of a learning curve in the U.S. I think, just fighting terrorism, that's based in fear. But if we can promote peace, it's based in hope. And I think the real enemy that we all face, whether it's in America or Afghanistan or Africa, is ignorance. And it's ignorance that breeds hatred. And I used to be lucky if a handful of maybe my relatives and friends showed up. But now it's, we get several thousand people everywhere we go. So I feel very honored that people really care about education. It's also, the last 3 or 4 years, I've become very close with the military. I think the military has gone through a huge learning curve, and they really get it. You know, many of our officers now have been in Afghanistan and Pakistan several times, and it's really about building relationships and listening more. General Petraeus, the CENTCOM commander, read Three Cups of Tea last year, and he sent me an email, and he said that there were 3 points he had learned from the book that he'd like to impart with the troops. Number one, we need to listen more. Number two, we need to have respect. And number three, that we have to build relationships. So Three Cups of Tea now is mandatory reading for all senior officers in the military and also for special forces deploying to Afghanistan.
Hmm. Well, that's great. It's good to know they're reading your book, because it certainly is an important book. Talk more about, because you do say that it's the key, and it's one of the things that haunts me in terms of, well, not only haunts, but it gives me great hope to know about schools like yours, about women getting some education. The literacy rate that you cite is just absolutely terrible. It's horrible in Afghanistan, much better in Pakistan. But the difference in education can make, and the struggles that a lot of women, because of culture, because of marriage things going on, how difficult it is for girls to get school, but, oh, it's needed, huh?
Oh, yeah, Kathleen. When I grew up in Africa, I learned a proverb, and it says that if we educate a boy, we educate an individual, but if we can educate a girl, we educate a community. And girls' education, I think it's the single most important priority we can have in the world today. We can drop bombs, we can build roads, we can put electricity, we can send in troops, but if girls aren't educated, a society will never change. And what happens with educating girls, first, there are some academic things. Number one, the infant mortality drops. Where we work, about 1 out of 3 children born dies before the age of 1. Secondly, it reduces the population explosion over 1 or 2 generations. And third, it improves the quality of health and life. Some other of my own observations are, when girls learn how to read and write, they generally teach their mothers how to read and write. So it spawns, hundreds of women's literacy programs. Also, when people come home from the marketplace and they have meat or vegetables wrapped in newspaper, you'll see the mothers very carefully unfolding a newspaper, and reading the news. Their daughter will read the news to her mother. That's a very powerful for those women to be able to see the news. And when someone goes on jihad, and jihad means a quest or a struggle, and it could mean, you know, going to college or joining a militant group or any kind of endeavor, they should get permission from their mother. And if they don't, it's very disgraceful. So when women have an education, I've seen that they're much less likely to encourage their sons to get into terrorism and violence. And that happened after 9/11. And even today, the Taliban, they primarily go to illiterate, impoverished society because many educated women refuse to allow their sons to join the Taliban. So, you know, I can't say, you know, I could talk to you for 5 hours about girls' education, but I think it's a key that we need to focus on.
So much of the book is filled with stories because you say those are the stories that move your heart and move you to do the extraordinary work that you do, Greg. I don't know how many we'll have a chance to hear, but if you would start with the dream deferred story, Nasreen Beg, is that how you pronounce her name?
Yes.
You start the book with her story, and it is so... Patience. Talk about patience and making a difference.
Yeah, Nasreen is a young woman who is from the Afghan-Pakistan border. She was a very bright student, the first girl out of maybe 8,000 to get an education. When she almost finished high school, unfortunately, her father died, and then she got into. Her life became very difficult. Then she started working, and she got married, and she got a very, I guess you want to say, you know, I hate to say this, evil stepmother, who was very, would taunt her and just, you know, literally beat her because she tried to study at night under the light of a kerosene lantern or a candle. And she said, you know, this will poison your mind. You need to work and be a good wife. And so she patiently toiled for 10 years, working, you know, virtual, almost slavery, very hard manual labor, potato, mostly harvesting and planting potatoes. And finally, she had a chance. We offered her a scholarship about 9 years ago, but her community refused. And finally, 2.5 years ago, they allowed her to get to go to training. And so now she's becoming a maternal health care worker, and she's actually advanced her studies now, so she'll become a graduate public health care worker, and she's planned to come back to her village and mainly work with maternal mortality. These are women who die during childbirth. One of her colleagues also, her name is Aziza. Aziza was the first girl to go to high school out of 4,000 people in another valley. And when she went to school, the boys threw stones at her, and in high school, the teachers refused to teach her because she's female. Anyhow, she graduated. In her valley, before Aziza started working there as a maternal health care worker to deliver babies, 5 to 20 women died in childbirth. So she went to 2 years of training. She came back in 2000, and in the last 9 years, not one single woman has died in childbirth. And her total education cost $800. And her pay today is about $1.25 per day. Mm. So that just shows you what one brave woman can do with her education.
Greg Mortensen is our guest this hour. He has a new book, Stones into Schools, Promoting Peace with Books, Not Bombs, in Afghanistan and Pakistan. He is the founder of 131 schools. Actually, the figure is probably more than that by now, in Afghanistan and Pakistan, providing education to nearly 58,000 students. The author of The Kite Runner, also a wonderful book, in the foreword to Greg's book, says that no single individual or organization has done more to advance the American cause in Afghanistan than Greg Mortensen. No wonder that the U.S. military has recruited him as a consultant on how to fashion better relationships with tribal leaders and village elders. They have a lot to learn from him. We all do. Our phone number, we have a couple lines open, 800-486-8255. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Greg has a lot of Wisconsin ties, his mom teaching school in River Falls, and the Pennies for Peace program starting here in the state of Wisconsin as well. So, to your phone calls in just one moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Greg Mortensen, author of Three Cups of Tea and now author of Stones into Schools, is our guest this hour, and we welcome phone calls for him. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655 for you to join our conversation. And our first caller, what is your name?
Joe.
Oh, hi, Joe. Go right ahead.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Greg, when I finished your first book, Three Cups of Tea, I think my biggest takeaway from that book was how putting money in a collection plate at church seemed like such a sanitized way of trying to help other people, again, after based on all the experiences and trials and tribulations you went through. And it really inspired me to try and find some other way to help other people by getting your skin in the game, so to speak. So that's my comment. My question for you is, after reading the book and since the conclusion of that book, I'm wondering how the conditions have changed in Afghanistan in terms of your efforts. Has the Taliban made it harder for you, in I guess, are they competing more than they have? Have schools been destroyed? Every time I hear about news, I often wonder how it's affected your efforts. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe.
Okay. Well, thank you, Joe. I appreciate your call. We've had our best year ever in Afghanistan the last couple years. And it's pretty much because we have relationships with the shura. These are the elders. Every province has about 10 to 20 elders. These are poets, mujahideen warriors, successful businessmen. They're not elected, but they're the pretty much the power base. And that's one thing that I'm really trying to encourage the United States government and our military to interact with more. The military has actually done an incredible job of dealing with the shura or the elders. We've had one school attacked, but we haven't had any destroyed. And overall, the bad news is that the Taliban have bombed or burned or destroyed over 1,000 schools in Afghanistan in the last 2.5 years, and another 800 schools in Pakistan. The good news, though, is that the number of kids in school in Afghanistan has gone in 2000, which was the height of the Taliban. There were 800,000, mostly boys, in school. This is age 5 to 15. This is a UNICEF figure, so 800,000 kids. And today, 9 years later, there are 8.5 million children in school, including 2.5 million females. And so the overall numbers continue to go up significantly. However, the Taliban are very deliberately, and the schools that I mentioned that were attacked, 90% of them are girls' schools. They're not boys' schools. And I think really that's their greatest fear. As I say, it's not a bullet, but it's a pen. The reason I think most of our schools aren't being attacked, and also some other great organizations like CARE and Oxfam, is because we insist on, we give skilled labor materials and then teacher training and support, which I think is most important. But the communities have to give free land, free labor, free wood, and free labor means 2,000 to 5,000 days of free manual labor. What that does is ensures local buy-in. We did have one school attack 2 years ago. It was called Lalander School in Charsiab Valley, about 2 hours south of Kabul. 14 Taliban came at night. They beat up the night watchman. And they said, if anybody comes to school, we're going to kill you. So the headmaster, he got on his bicycle, he pedaled 23 miles, and he notified the local militia leader. His name is Commandant Fahim. Now, Commandant Fahim is kind of a shady guy, but he also has two daughters in school. So he got quite upset. He rounded up 120 men, and he formed a Lashkar, which means a vigilante or posse. And he attacked the Taliban. He killed two of them. And he found out they had gotten $3,000 from the local mullah to shut the school down. So now the mullah and three of the Taliban are in jail, and Commandant Fahim has appointed 12 askar, which are militiamen, to guard the Lander School 24/7. And there are orders are if anybody harms any girl or child or teacher going to the school, just shoot them. Now that's not how we run a school, but that's how they run their school. And so, but again, it shows you kind of the fierce devotion of the communities to their education when they put significant amount of sweat equity into it.
Thank you so much for the call. Ken is next from Milton. Hi, Ken.
Hi. I just want to take a minute to thank Mr. Severson for going public. I mean, on behalf of all the shy people in the world, first of all, is all I want to say. Thank you for what it took to go public with this. I saw you on 60 Minutes. Thank you again on behalf of all the shy people.
Was it hard for you to go to public, Greg?
Well, thanks, Ken, and I have great admiration for. I was very shy, very reserved person, and actually, what made me go public was after 9/11. I was in Pakistan and Afghanistan for several months, and when I came home in late 2001, when I got home, it was actually Halloween Day, and I walked into my basement office and I started getting hate mail and threats from Americans, and subsequently I got death threats. And that was the only time in my whole life I thought about quitting my job. And my wife, Tara, she actually told me, you need to get out in public and talk about what you're doing and share what you're experiencing and seeing and talk about the good people in America and Afghanistan and Pakistan. So that's what I did, and it was very difficult, but you know, from that experience, I found that, you know, as I mentioned before, that Americans were really good people and were very compassionate and caring people, and I feel a great blessing. I visit about now 100 and maybe 10 to 20 cities a year. I also, my favorite thing is to go to schools, primary, elementary schools all the way through the Air Force Academy. And one of the first questions that I ask students is, how many of you have spent a lot of time talking to your grandparents or your elders about the Depression or World War II or the Vietnam War or the Civil Rights Movement? And generally in the U.S., only about 10% of the hands come up. Now, if I ask the same exact question in Afghanistan or Pakistan, 90% or 100% of the hands come up. And I think it's a great tragedy in our country that we've lost the tradition where we can learn from our elders. It's about our heritage, our culture, our folklore, our faith, and many of the important lessons in history. So through our Pennies for Peace program, we're very diligently trying to get kids in the U.S. to spend more time with their elders and learn from them, because I think it's very critical for a society, to preserve our culture and heritage and traditions and folklore. And we need to do that by strengthening the bond between our elders and the youth.
And we have the great technology here to be able to preserve it forever, right?
Oh, exactly. You're right, Kathleen. Yep.
Yeah. Tell me about your mentors. And I know there were several of them, but some were extremely important to you in Afghanistan or in Pakistan. Who really taught you?
Well, the first mentor I had was Haji Ali, who's a village chief in Corfe in Pakistan. I first met him in 1993 after I came off of K2. He lived until 2001. He was the one who taught me what three cups of tea means. And what it means is the first cup, you're a stranger, second cup of tea, you're a friend, and third cup of tea, you're family. And for a family, we're prepared to do anything, even die. Now, he didn't mean you just go around drinking lots of tea and having peace, but what he was inferring is that it's imperative that we take some time and build relationships. He also taught me the very important lesson that I needed to let go and let the communities do the work. And as I mentioned before, that's the basis of all our work today. We provide the skilled labor, materials, and teacher training, but the community has to provide free land and sweat equity, and we let the communities run the schools. And of those you know, 1,800 schools that I mentioned that the Taliban have bombed or destroyed or shut down, most of those schools were set up by outside contractors. The community doesn't know who built the school, you know, how much money went into it, who got the money. And those are the schools that are being targeted. They're not targeting schools where the community has such a you know, devotion to. There's a topic of the 30,000 troops deployed to Afghanistan, and I have some mixed feelings about it. Number one, I think it's important for the public to know, which the public's not very aware of, that first 8 of the 22,000 troops deployed to Afghanistan this year are trainer troops. They're mostly from the National Guard, from the Reserve, and these troops are veterinarians, dentists, horticulturalists, accountants, and they're really trying to help the people get on their feet. Hmm. And of these 30,000 troops deployed to Afghanistan now, about a third of them, about 10,000 again, are trainer troops. And that's really what the shura, or the elders in Afghanistan, are asking for. They say, we do not need firepower, we need brain power. And the alternative to deploying troops, which Vice President Joe Biden is recommending, and also conservative columnist George Will, is that we pull troops, but we do more targeted, selected bombings. But the problem with bombings is that you kill more civilians. There's been about... the bombings have gone down, but even in the last year, more than 780 civilians have been killed. With that, only about 50 al-Qaeda were killed. And that's their main complaint, is please do not bomb us. You know, if you want somebody captured or killed, we'll be happy to do ourselves, but please do not bomb us. And if you do bombings, you need intelligence. So I don't think that bombings is a replacement to more troops. And part of the McChrystal plan, General McChrystal, he sent a report out in August, and I'd encourage all the listeners to actually, it's on the internet, it's only 68 pages long, and if you read it, it's more like a master's thesis in sociology or anthropology. A lot of it talks about building relationships and listening, and I think it's a brilliant report, and I would encourage people, you know, before you start making your decisions, to read the report and also understand that I think the military, even more than the State Department or political leaders, they really get it. It's about building relationships, and I'm hopeful that Holbrook and Secretary Clinton will spend more time meeting with the people and the elders over there. They've only been over there once since they've been in office, and I think they need to do a lot more.
Well, what about, why don't we have 30,000, those 30,000 troops all be trainer troops?
Well, that would be great. And, you know, I had some columnists say we need 30,000 Birkenstock warriors, which would be, that would be great. But the problem is that the U.S. military is in a very difficult position now. They have to be warriors, diplomats, and humanitarians. And there's been criticisms from some of the bigger organizations. They say that the Department of Defense, DOD, is getting too much money for development work. But if you look at these very rural areas, the only people there are the U.S. military, some forward operating bases, and then a few crazy people like me. And and we're able to function in very, you know, volatile areas or areas where the Taliban are, because we have those relationships with the elders. And so we're able to, this year we set up the first girls' high school in 5 new provinces in Afghanistan, but we could have never have done that if we didn't have the relationships with the people there. We've right. been working on them for years and years.
Yeah. Let's go to Zoe from Onalaska next, Greg. Hi, Zoe.
Hi, Greg. Thanks for taking my call. I'm from Onalaska, and I'm 10 years old, and I go to Irving Perch Elementary School, and we're doing the Pennies for Peace project, and we're reading your book in literature circles, and I think that your book is really cool.
Well, that's so cool, Zoe, and you're at the last town and the last place in the end of the road, so that's really special, and I'll look up your school, and I'll get in touch with you, but that is so cool, and keep up the good work, and I think it's especially cool because you're the last village and the last place and the last end of the road.
What do you think of his book, Zoe?
I think it's really cool, and I think that all the stuff in there, my class sometimes has a hard time believing that it's actually true, but we know it is, and we just think it's really awesome. So, I think that I'll definitely read any more books that you write.
Zoe, what grade are you in?
I'm in fifth grade.
Oh, fifth grade. My son's in fourth grade, and the new book, Stones into Schools, we're going to make it into a young reader's version, and we're going to put more maps and charts and diagrams. And we, you know, if you have any feedback, send it to our Pennies for Peace site, because we'd love to have some feedback, and we'll, you know, we're going to include some kids who, you know, have some ideas. And we're going to also talk about landmines in that book, because there's a lot of kids who get hurt in landmines in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and so we want to bring more awareness to that. But thanks, Zoe. That's really cool, and really appreciate your call. Thanks so much.
Yes, thanks for listening, Zoe. That's Pennies for Peace, the website?
Yes, penniesforpeace.org.
Okay. Let us go next to Sarah is next from Madison. Hi, Sarah.
Hello.
Hello.
Some of the questions that I had have already been answered, but I do want to say, you know, thank you for sharing, you know, sometimes of the political stuff that we don't hear that end of the story. Usually, even listening to NPR and All Things Considered, I love the story about the protecting the school that was attacked. I'm wondering about, would you say the same thing is happening in Pakistan? You know, now Pakistan is all heating up. Is the same protection granted to your schools there? So that's one question. And my second comment is just how the community support of education is kind of humbling when we think of what education reform and money is in our society. And I'll take the comments off the air.
Thank you, Sarah.
Well, thanks, Sarah. The first question related to, we have the same exact thing in Pakistan. The communities are fiercely devoted to protecting the schools. Something else that's happening in Pakistan, too, is the people are starting to, I see the tide of support for the Taliban turning quite significantly. People are just getting sick and tired of having outsiders coming in and dictate to them. The Taliban also are becoming more fractured. In many ways, they're becoming more like a mafia or a gang. I was at Camp Lejeune, which is where the Marine Special Forces train, and I was there for a couple days. I found it very interesting that they embed some of their Marine Corps going to Afghanistan. They embed with gangs in Los Angeles for 4 to 6 weeks before they deploy to Afghanistan to learn more about gang warfare. And in Pakistan, the same thing is happening, where the mafia are becoming more criminal. They more extortion, crime. They do a lot illicit lumber trafficking, heroin trafficking, but it doesn't really win over the people. The same thing happened to Hamas in Palestine. As a militant group, they had a lot of popular support. They were voted into power in January 2006, but now as a political entity, they're not able to provide the basic things that all people want, and that's, you know, education, healthcare, roads, electricity. I think the other thing that I find so compelling, and really perhaps the main reason I do this, is I've learned from my father and Haji Ali and even General Petraeus to listen more. And so I ask women in a rural Afghanistan, Pakistan, what would you like? You know, I want to help you, but what do you want? And you think most women say, I want a big house, or I want a good husband, or I want prosperity. But most women, they tell me two simple things, and that simply is, we don't want our babies to die, and we want our children to go to school. I think even all your listening audience, those of you who are mothers and women, I think you can relate to that. You don't want your children to die, and you want them to have hope through education. So I guess that's really what kind of spurs me on year after year.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. And it's not always easy, Greg.
Yeah, sometimes I was kidnapped for 8 days in 96, and I've had a couple of fatwas issued against me, and I've gotten threats here in the U.S., and I have to be away from my family half the year.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of... I also feel very blessed. My wife, I think, is a saint. I met her in September 95, and we got married 6 days later. But I knew that... We both knew that we were meant for each other, and we work very hard to, when I'm home, that I can spend time with the kids, and my wife and I have a date every Tuesday, regardless of anything. And Saturday is a kids' day, so my kids know that on Saturday they can have me for whatever they want.
Oh.
Now, sometimes they don't even want to talk to me, but on Saturday, but that's so. It's not easy, but I feel very blessed, and it's an honor to. You know, on behalf of the American people, that we can do some good in Afghanistan.
Oh, well, it's such a life. It's such a large life. Tell me about your capture, how that happened and how you got released and how you dealt with that capture. I'm sure, did some listening even then.
Well, this is a while back in July of 96. It was the beginning of the Taliban. My mistake was I went into an area I'd never been before, and this is Waziristan, where a lot of conflict is going on right now, and it was where the Taliban first started up. And so when I went in there, I didn't ask for permission to be their guest. And this is in Pashto, it's called Nanawati, means the right of refuge. And so I got kidnapped. I was detained for 8 days. I was by armed kidnapping, and the first 2 days I got really depressed because I didn't know if they wanted money or they were going to kill me or why they had kidnapped me. My wife Tara was 7 months pregnant, and I thought, I've got to get home to see her. So I realized perhaps the best way for me to get out of there was to befriend my captors. So the first thing I did was ask them to bring a Quran and teach me about their faith, and we had some good discussion. And then on the sixth day, I told them that I need to go home to see the birth of my firstborn son.
Mm-hmm.
And in their culture, the birth of firstborn son is life's greatest event. So that really won them over, and 2 days later they released me. And they told me part of the reason I got released was because of my sincerity to try and understand their culture. And they even gave me 10,000 rupees, which is about $300.
Oh, my goodness.
Because they found out I'm trying to help, build schools in Pakistan. And, I write about it in a little bit humorous way, but actually it was pretty serious. And, I was very frightening, and hopefully I never have to have that happen again.
Yeah. You've lived through it. I hope it doesn't happen ever again either. Okay, more phone calls. Greg Mortensen is our guest this hour. His latest book is Stones into Schools, Promoting Peace with Books, Not Bombs, in Afghanistan and Pakistan. He's the author, much requested for this show, I might add, of Three Cups of Tea. Our number is 800-486-8655. One line has opened if you'd like to get it. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Greg Mortensen is our guest, and we go to Kurt from Chippewa Falls. Hi, Kurt.
Good morning. Very good to hear you again. Mr. Mortensen, I heard you last night was on the delayed broadcast of On Point with Tom Ashbrook. And it's very encouraging, especially with regard to as you described the U.S. military's creativity and resourcefulness and adaptiveness. My question is, there's a history to everything, and we know that the history of U.S. military involvement, as with any country's military involvement in other countries. I'm concerned. Are you concerned with the possibility that, whereas the military on the ground in Pakistan, Afghanistan, is seeing the light, as it were, and is taking the approach that you're describing, but they are, the military, of course, is accountable to higher authority, which may have other agendas other than what you're describing, and that in time you and your efforts could be co-opted and take a good thing and turn it bad.
Well, thanks, Kurt, and those are some very insightful, you know, on your part, and I think it is, as you mentioned, it's very important that we make sure that we differentiate that we've never taken a dollar of federal money, and we probably never will, and especially don't take any Department of Defense money. And all of my involvement with the military and our organization, we do it entirely, you know, on a voluntary basis. But we're very careful that we don't be perceived as a instrument of the U.S. government, because, as you mentioned, sometimes the higher ups have a little bit of a different agenda, and we don't want to, you know, we don't want to be to appear to fall into that. I can also, you know, having spoken several times with several military commanders, including like Admiral Mike Mullen, Chairman Joint Chief of Staff, General Conway, who's the Marine Corps Commandant, General Petraeus, they will all say that there is, you know, point blank, there is no military solution in Afghanistan or Pakistan. They're very aware of that. General Conway is also very aware of the fact that not one army that has gone into Afghanistan has ever, you know, quote, won. They've all been defeated by the Afghans. And the most important thing that I see the military doing, which I don't see the State Department and our political leaders doing, is the military is working very hard to develop relationships with the elders and the people in the rural areas, and that is a key to success. And they're doing it in the basis of training the Afghan army, the police, and also more of the civil, you know, like with engineering. And in order to get our work done, you know, we pretty much talk to anybody. Sometimes we have to deal with pretty shady people, and, you know, also talk to the U.S. military. And I have great admiration for the military, but as you mentioned, I'm also, you know, I also take a lot of precaution because, as you mentioned, that there are sometimes ulterior motives from higher up, and it's a kind of fine line that you have to keep.
What is it that the military can do, or those people who are trainers, to give the Afghan people the kind of government they deserve, Greg? We keep hearing these reports about this massive corruption and the opium trade, et cetera. I'm wondering how important the government is to the people you're dealing with in very remote areas and more populated areas on the ground, and what it is the government could do to make their lives better, and how anybody helps accomplish that.
Well, the government in Afghanistan, I hate to say this, but it's very fickle, and it's also extremely corrupt, especially at the, you know, governor and then the ministerial level. And it's very difficult to work out of those contexts. And I think the mistake was, it started in the Bonn Conference in December 2001, but 18 countries, including the U.S., got together, and they decided how to rebuild the country. And it was a centralized, deprovincialized type of system. And some, you remember, Kathleen, after World War II, is the Marshall Plan.
Mm-hmm.
And I studied it extensively. The Marshall Plan, I think, was a brilliant plan. And the architects who designed it, they were genius. But the way the Marshall Plan was set up, especially in Italy and a little bit in Japan, is that it was provincialized and decentralized. And so in Afghanistan, the U.S., we completely flipped it around. And only recently, in the last two or three years, we really started looking at putting more power and autonomy at the provincial and the district level. And the centralized Afghanistan is a very multi-ethnic, feudal type of society. And the type of centralized government that we have helped establish, it really isn't working very well. And that is something that the elders quite loathe, because there's just so much corruption, like a governor has to pay about $1 million to get his job, and then get very lucrative contracts, you know, mostly coming through the U.S. to pay back these people that put him in power. And I'm speaking not on myself, but I'm speaking on behalf of the, you know, many of the elders that I've talked to, and it's very frustrating. And when you empower the people and at the district level and put them in charge, then they can go, you know, then they're able to deal with the corrupt government. And you know, we can't really deal that much. We work with the government, but we work through and on behalf of the people. That's the way we're able to get around that extreme corruption.
Mm-hmm. We go to Jillian next from Madison. Hi, Jillian.
Yes, good morning, and good morning, Mr. Mortensen. I read your book, I think a year or so ago, and it was just such a powerful, inspiring book, and I have been lending it and talking to people to read it ever since, and hearing you is just a great experience to hear what you have to say as to what you're doing now, and the fact that you are working with the military and educating and helping them understand how important it is at the communal level. Because it's so discouraging and it's so disheartening to see so many civilians being killed in this particular situation, and in, of course, other wars. We don't get peace at the end of a barrel of a gun, obviously. And it's just wonderful to hear what you're doing. I just wanted to also say that I love the story of your romance with your wife, and it was just great to. I think you were destined. Clearly, for each other, because you've done so much, and she, yes, must be a saint. Because I know how much time you have to spend away from your family. One question I did have about your children, what are they doing? I'm sure they must be extremely inspired by their dad as to what they're doing. And I think your daughter, isn't she involved in Pennies for Peace?
Well, thank you. Is it Julie or Julia?
Jillian.
Jillian, okay. Oh, thanks, Jillian. And I appreciate you asking about my kids, because that's really on my heart a lot. But my wife, I definitely think she's a saint. She's also, she says when I'm gone, she pretty much has to go into what she calls functional denial, meaning that, you know, she, when I'm gone, that she might not hear from me. I might be, you know, something might happen to me. And even, you know, on behalf of hundreds of thousands of kids and women and men whose wives are work in humanitarian work or in aid work or missions or military, you know, they make a great sacrifice, and I think we should do everything we can to support them. My daughter, Amira, she loves to sing. She's also very involved with Pennies for Peace. They join me on the road quite a bit now, and she loves to get up in front of audiences and share, and especially kids. My son Kyber is like me. He's quite shy. He's very he's very high tech though, so he helped design my PowerPoints, and he sits in the back. And I'm very close with my family, and my mother-in-law lives a block away, and then my mother comes to stay with us about 4 months a year. I also should mention my mother was also principal for several years in Shawnee, Wisconsin. So she also worked there for I think about 6 years. So we've got definitely incredible support from Wisconsin, and I'm so grateful to the people there, and especially the kids from Westside School who got this all going with Pennies, because I wouldn't be here today had it not been for those Pennies in River Falls, Wisconsin.
Oh, isn't it? It's always a moment, isn't it, that starts the whole thing usually.
Exactly.
Yeah. Thank you, Jillian, so much for the call.
Thank you, Jillian.
We have just one minute left. Ruth from Elton. Hi.
Hi, I'll make my comments quick here. I'm just struck by the similarities of what I found to be true when I worked in poverty within our own country. And I just want to help the listeners make this leap and encourage a sense of hope, resolve to deal with the poverty in our own country, as well as what's going on in places like Afghanistan. You know, you bring hope to what seems like a hopeless situation in Afghanistan. And in the same way, people think there's nothing we can do about poverty in our own country, but it's about, you know, there's massive corruption, there's crime, a war zone kind of environment, but mothers want the same thing. They want their babies to be safe. They want their kids to go to school, and they have the solutions if we listen to them.
Greg.
Well, thanks, Ruth. I think it's so important that my kids go to public school, and I'm very aware of, you know, the lack of support for public education in our country. And I'm in Albuquerque. I met some homeless kids in Albuquerque yesterday, and it was very, very touching, very, very sad too. And I think we, you know, if we spent 99 pennies here in the U.S. to help deal with our problems, and then just one penny could go overseas, we would do very well. And also, really, to poverty. I think to really alleviate or cure poverty, we have to touch poverty, and we have to taste poverty, and smell poverty, and be with poverty. And I'm so glad to hear, Ruth, your concern about it. But it's
Greg, we're out of time. Thank you so much. You were just
a
real inspiration.
Been wonderful.
Thank you.
Thanks to everybody in Wisconsin for your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Greg Mortensen, the new book is Stones into Schools. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. John Treader for On Air Production. We'll be with you tomorrow.